Hello, Apostolic Insiders. Welcome to the Staples household once again, although this time the Staples household is on the move. We're presently driving on our anniversary little excursion. We're heading up to Temecula to do some wine tasting in wine country. And I wanted to drop you guys a little note. We're going to take a look at the readings for this week, the 21st Sunday in Ordinary Time. And I know I will continue to sound like a broken record when I say these readings are awesome, as they are every week. We're going to really zero in on just two of the readings, although we'll mention the psalm. And the first reading is a famous text from Isaiah 22, verses 15 through 23. The famous text that is the sort of prophetic undergirding for the gospel reading this week, which is the famous Matthew 16, verses 13 through 20. The keys of the kingdom. Thou art Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church. And I have to preface my remarks by saying, you know, when I was a Protestant, I remember well what I used to say about this text, and that is, you Catholics are nuts. Because obviously, we said, Jesus is not building his church on Peter and his successors, the popes, right? That's crazy. No. He's building the church upon himself. And the key was, we used to make the distinction between rocks, basing it, allegedly, right, falsely, on the two different words that are used for rock here. When Jesus says, you are Peter, we know that Greek word there is Petros. We used to say that means a little tiny pebble. And upon Taute Petra, or this rock, Petra, I will build my church. The claim was made that Petra is a massive boulder. And so, of course, the massive boulder would be Jesus Christ. And we would go to verses of scripture like 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 4. The rock which followed them was Christ. Or 1 Corinthians 3, verse 11. No other foundation can any man lay except that which is laid, Jesus Christ, right? So, obviously, these Catholics have it wrong. Jesus isn't building his church upon Peter. He's building it upon himself. Peter being the little rock, Jesus being the massive boulder. And then there's actually a second understanding that is actually the more ancient, meaning it goes back to the original reformers 500 years ago, who, as we'll see in a little while, John Calvin acknowledge that the two rocks are the same rocks. But there was this other false understanding that says that Jesus is not building his church upon Peter, but upon the faith or the revelation that Peter received, separating that revelation from the person of Peter. Right? And as we'll see in a little bit, the church has no problem with saying the church is built upon the revelation that Peter got. Thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God. But you can't separate Peter from the revelation. So yes, it's, you know, the faith of Peter, but it's the faith of Peter, folks. All right, now with that as a foundation, let's begin with the reading there from Isaiah 22, 15 through 22. Now, for lack of time, I'm not going to be able to read the text. The text is so rich. But just let's pull out some of the most important points here. The context is Hezekiah is the king of Israel. And we have to understand that in ancient Israel, going back to the kingdom of David, David, of course, and his successors, the kings, are the ruling authority in Israel, but they had underneath them what's called the prime minister or the master of the palace, who was the second most authoritative voice in Israel when it came to things political concerning the kingdom of David on earth. Of course, the queen mother would have been the most powerful voice in the kingdom. And of course, there were the high priest had a powerful voice, but the prime minister, when it came to the kingdom, to the palace, his word was the word of the king. And the context here in Isaiah 22, 15 through 22, is you had Shebna, who was the master of the palace during the reign of Hezekiah, became corrupt. And so the prophet Isaiah comes to him and declares God's going to remove him from his position of authority and establish Eliakim in his place. And if you skip down there to verses 20 through 22, you really get the language here of authority, where he says, I will strip, talking to Shebna, I will strip you of your robe, the symbol of authority, and I will place Eliakim in your place, and he will be a father to the inhabitants of Jerusalem and to Judah. A father. Does that ring a bell, folks? That's one of the reasons why we call our Pope what? Papa. Yeah, Holy Father, Papa. Pope means father. He will prophetically be a father over Jerusalem and Judah. And of course, we know that the church in Galatians 6:15 is the Israel of God. Jesus reestablishes, reconstitutes, if you will, the kingdom of David, although he does more than just reconstitute. He fulfills and takes it beyond. But, the kingdom of heaven on earth is the church at the time of Christ. So he will be a father to the inhabitants of Jerusalem and to Judah. And he shall shut, and no man shall open, and he shall open, and no man shall shut. And I will give to him the key of the house of David. Oh, that's a key phrase right there, right? So here we go, the key, right? Well, in the New Testament, now think about it. Here we have the Old Testament, guys being replaced. There's a successor, right? Because in other words, when Shebna turned bad, they didn't say, oh, bummer, Shebna's gone now, so there's no more master of the palace, no more prime minister. No, there was a successor of the prime minister chosen in Eliakim, right? This is the context, the backdrop of where Jesus establishes Peter as his, as Matthew chapter 10, verse 2 had said, his first apostle, first meaning chief there, protos. He is the first, the chief of the apostles. And the context is set in the context of the divinic kingdom being restored, reconstituted, taken to a new level, of course, in Jesus Christ. And you'll notice that it comes about because in Matthew 16, 13, now we'll skip up to the gospel reading, Jesus asked the apostles the question, who do men say that I am? And of course, they respond, you know, some say you're Jeremiah, some say you're Elijah, some say you're the prophet. And Jesus asked them, who do you say that I am? And notice it is Peter among the 12 who declares, thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God. And it's in that context that Jesus says, blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah. Right? No doubt in the context of the revelation that Peter received. But remember, it's not just the revelation, because Jesus then uses this as his impetus or the occasion to establish Peter, not just his confession, but Peter as his authority in his church. He says, you are Peter. Or first, blessed are you, Simon. There I go. Blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, or John, for flesh and blood hath not revealed this unto you, but my Father who is in heaven. And I say to you, you are Peter, the rock, and upon Talte Petra, upon this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. And I will give to you the keys of the kingdom of heaven. Whatever you bind on earth shall be bound in heaven. Whatever you loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven. Clearly now, we see this as a fulfillment of Isaiah 22, verses 15 through 23. But now, here's what I used to say as a Protestant is, no, you guys are trying to pull something out of a hat here, right? Because it ain't happening. Because notice, they would say there's a difference in rocks. Because here, Jesus is, or I should say a difference in keys, not rocks. Here, Jesus mentions keys in the plural. But in Isaiah, it's singular. I will give to him the key of the house of David. It didn't say keys, it says key, right? Well, folks, if we're going to be persnickety here, Revelation chapter 1, verse 18, Jesus says, I am he who has the keys, plural, of death and Hades. So Jesus not only has the key of the house of David, but he has the keys. And by the way, folks, just to me, this is airtight. If you go to Revelation chapter 3, verse 7, remember we just quoted Revelation 1:18, he has the keys. Revelation 3:7, Jesus actually quotes this very text from Isaiah 22. And he says, I am he who has the key of the house of David, right? Well, now my Protestant friends will say, well, doesn't that prove the point then? That he's not given the keys to Peter, because he clearly says he has the key of the house of David here. So the Protestant position is right, right? Wrong! Why? Because, folks, it can't get any more plain that Jesus has the key. But, folks, when you understand the nature of the key of the house of David in the Old Testament, it wasn't as if, you know, King Hezekiah had the key, but when he gave the key to Shebna and then to Eliakim, his successor, somehow King Hezekiah has nothing to do anymore. He just has to twiddle his thumbs. Oh, I don't have any authority anymore because I gave the key to Shebna and now to Eliakim. Of course not. Of course the king retains the fullness of the power of the key of the house of David, or the keys of Matthew 16 and Revelation 1:18. Of course the king retains the power. But the whole point is, he's delegating authority to Shebna, to Eliakim, when he communicates the key. And what is Jesus doing? As the true King of Kings and Lord of Lords, as Revelation 19:16 says, he is the fulfillment of the Davidic kingdom. Of course he has the keys, but the point is, who does he give the keys to? My friends, it is airtight. It is to Peter. Now, with that as kind of a foundation, I want to talk just a little bit in more detail about this, because many Protestants, I'll give several examples here, but many Protestants, including myself when I was Protestant, they teach that these two rocks have distinct meanings. They will say, as I once did, that Petros meant a little rock. So when Jesus says, you are Petros, it would be like saying, you're a little rock. You're a little tiny pebble. And upon this rock, right, and that's Petra, massive boulder, I will build my church. See how they will say then that these are two different rocks, so he's not building his church upon the little rock. He's building it upon the massive rock that is himself. Now, what's the problem with that? Well, the bottom line is, my friends, it simply is false. They are not two different words with distinct meanings. In fact, they both have the same root. They are different words in as much as, in fact, Petros was an ancient Greek word used, you know, in what's called Attic Greek, ancient Greek, as a distinct word. But it had fallen out of use by the time of the Koine Greek of the first century. You don't find Petros anymore. Petra, yes, but it just wasn't used very much anymore. But there was simply no difference in meaning. In fact, Petros and Petra both meant rock, and they could be used in the context of a big rock or a little rock. It simply did not exist. The difference in meaning did not exist. What's happening here is, because Petra was historically a feminine noun, when Matthew's writing his gospel, And, you know, he's going to write. Remember, Jesus spoke in Aramaic. He didn't speak in Greek. And so when Matthew's writing his gospel, and all the gospel writers, they're translating from Aramaic into Greek. And there was a problem, because when you translate the Aramaic into Greek, you're naturally going to use Petra as the word for rock. But here's the rub. Petra had never been used for a name before. In other words, nobody had ever been named Rocky before. It just didn't exist as a name. And so, because Peter is a male, you couldn't name him Petra. Because that would be like, you know, me calling some man Paula or Catherine or something. And so he had to create a new name that had never been used before. Petros. See, I had to change the alpha, because if you leave it Petra, it's feminine. He changed it to Omicron Sigma to make it a masculine name. And that's it, folks. That's why the name change happened. There's not two different meanings. It is simply rock. But now we need to make another point. I mentioned in passing, we have really good evidence that Matthew's gospel actually was first written. Now, we know, as I said before, Jesus spoke in Aramaic, but there is really good evidence, pretty clear evidence, that St. Matthew actually wrote a gospel first in Aramaic. In fact, this is attested to by Papias in his explanation of the sayings of the Lord in AD 130. This was a fellow who knew John the Apostle, right? And he testified to this. And so did St. Irenaeus, who was a disciple of Polycarp, who was a disciple of John. And Irenaeus is writing in about 180 AD. And so we have very good evidence that Matthew first actually wrote in Aramaic. Now, why is that significant? Because what would Jesus have actually said, and what would Matthew have actually written when he first wrote his gospel? Well, there's no doubt. It would have been, "You are Kepha, and upon Kepha I will build my church." There was no distinction between the two rocks. And we have evidence of this from what's called the Peshitta, which is the Syriac translation of the scriptures. It's a 4th century translation in Syriac, which is a cognate, a sister language of Aramaic, and it actually is written as, "You are Kepha, and upon Kepha I will build my church." But even more than that, and Val, this is really significant. John chapter 1 verse 42, we have inspired scripture that demonstrates that Jesus would have originally spoken in Aramaic, and he used the word Kepha when he actually said those words to Peter. That, my friends, is airtight. You say, what? What are you talking about? Well, go to John chapter 1, verse 42. The scripture says, Andrew brought Peter to Jesus. Jesus looked at him and said, "So you are Simon, the son of John. You shall be called Kepha," which means, or which is translated, Petros. Notice how John is quoting Jesus. And he said, Kepha, which he then translates into Petra, or Petros. My friends, this is airtight. The fact is, when Jesus said those words, he said, "You are Kepha, and upon Kepha I will build my church." There's no distinction in rocks. This is an invention of Protestants. But now let's make another point here. Because if you go back to the Greek text, which is the most important, because all Christians agree, that's inspired, that is authoritative. There are, in fact, several words the inspired author could have used. If he wanted to say large rock, small rock, he could have used, for example, lithos, because lithos is used all over the New Testament as small rock, small stone. In fact, in John chapter 10, when they pick up stones to stone Jesus, the scripture uses lithoi. And there are so many examples in the New Testament. It is most commonly small stone. Now, it can also mean a massive stone, because the massive stone that they rolled in front of Jesus' tomb in Matthew's gospel is lithos, right? So it can be either. And the same can be said for Petra. We have examples of Petra, both as large stone and small stone. In Joshua chapter 5, verses 2 and 3, for example, God said to Joshua, make flint knives and circumcise the Israelite nations. So Joshua made rock knives, right? Small little rocks. He uses Petra, right? So Petra is not always massive boulder. In Job 22, 23, and 24, if you return to the Almighty and humble yourself, if you remove unrighteousness far from your tents, if you lay gold in the dust and gold of Ophir among the stones of the torrent bed, and if the Almighty is your gold and your precious silver, you will delight yourself in the Almighty. There, both dust and pebbles, these are small, the dust is really tiny rocks, right? And it uses Petra. In fact, I was just online today reading several Protestant so-called scholars who were saying Petra has never used a small rock. And that is just crazy, my friends. It is simply not true. Lithos is small, big rock. But here's the bottom line. There is a word that always means little rock in Greek. And it is psephos. And psephos is used in the book of Revelation, chapter 2, verse 17, as when Jesus gives us all a name. When we get to heaven, folks, you're going to get a name that only you and Jesus knows, and it's going to be written on a small little rock. Of course, this is a symbol, but a little psephos. And psephos always means little rock. The bottom line is, my friends, and if I had time, I could show you Craig Keener, the Protestant scholar. I could show you Dr. D.A. Carson. I could show you Dr. Oscar Kuhlmann. I could show you John Calvin, my friends. We don't have time to look at all these, but all of them acknowledge that the difference between big rock and little rock is an invention. It doesn't exist in the Greek text. The fact is, Peter is the rock upon which Christ built his church. But now, if we go and get away from the Greek for a while, and let's look at something really simple, folks. All right? Really simple. This is common sense. The fact is, if you look at the text just plain and simple, blessed are you, so I say to you, you are Peter. In the context of communicating authority, he uses Jesus, the second person, personal pronoun, seven times in three verses, communicating the fact that he is communicating his authority to Peter. Seven times. In other words, you, seven times in three verses. It makes absolutely no sense. I say to you, you are Peter, you know, upon this rock I'll build my church, and I'll give to you the keys of heaven, whatever you bind on earth, whatever you lose on earth, over and over again seven times. But by the way, I'm building the church on me. Right. It simply makes no sense. Jesus is being portrayed as the wise man. If you go back, same Gospel of Matthew, chapter 7, you know, he's the wise man who builds his house upon a rock. Right? He's the builder. The builder doesn't build a rock or a house upon himself. My friends, he's building it upon someone else, and it is Peter. Now, my friends, there is so much we could talk about more here, but unfortunately, we are out of time. The bottom line is, we have a great gift in the gift of the papacy, where here Jesus communicates his authority. Why? So that we can have a sure word from heaven. My friends, if you have a house without a head, there's only two possible options if you don't have a head. You either have a headless corpse or you have a two-headed monster. Because if you're going to have a house, a business, or a church, of course, somebody has to be in charge. And Jesus was too smart to build a church without anybody in charge. He built the church upon Peter. And my friends, it didn't end with Peter, as we already said. Clearly, the context of Matthew 16, as the readings this week bring out so beautifully, the whole context is the context of succession. So that just as when Shebna was wicked and was removed from office, the children of Israel didn't say, oh, bummer,
we lost a great thing in the church here, but it's gone, or among the people of God, I should say, in the Old Testament, but it's gone now. No, they chose a successor. And the same thing happens with Peter and all of the apostles. As we see in Acts chapter 1, verse 20, it would be Peter who made the rules in choosing a successor, a replacement successor for Judas when Judas had died. In Acts chapter 1, verse 20, it would be Peter and his successors that would make the rules for their successors as well. And you know what? I'll wrap my thoughts up with this. The psalm this week is Psalm 138, verse 8, where, you know, it's kind of interesting how the church put this psalm right in the middle of all this talk of authority. And the church here, and I'm just going to quote this one verse among the eight that are quoted in the psalm, Psalm 138, verses 1 through 8. But it says, Lord, whoa. Sorry. Your love is eternal. Sorry, we almost crashed, but right. It's okay. Psalm 138, verse 8 says, Lord, your love is eternal. Do not leave us alone. Not leave us to our own devices. What a beautiful text, because really, ultimately, that's why we have a papacy. That's why we have the authority of the church. It's because of the eternal love of God. And he loves us too much to leave us to our own devices. God bless you.